and a kind of mirror closet. It was a box of mirrors that had a latch and pulled open so that you could stand surrounded by every possible view of yourself whilst dressing. Daphne's room. Daphne had been gone for 4 years. This was the state of things. Him living in two rooms, just his study and a bedroom, the one next door to this. I tried not to show that it made me sad. We undressed. He turned the light out and lay down beside me. He kissed me and parted my legs with a stroke of his hand. He was gentle at first and rocked slowly. Then he pressed all the breath out of me, little by little. At first it was good. And then it wasn't good. Our bodies were cold and it hurt when he moved inside me. I didn't wince or cry out. I kept my eyes firmly closed. Stop once he feels that it's hurting me. But he didn't. He stopped when he was finished. I can't stay here, he said. And he left, stumbling over things, shadows, slippers, whatever was on the floor. Minutes pricked shallowly like thorns. I shivered in my chemise. I'd never slept in a four-poster before. My dreams came framed by the purple velvet of the canopy. I kept waking up, or thinking that I did. I couldn't tell. This was Daphne's bed. Daphne Fox had lain here, looking up into this canopy. How had she lain? What had she looked at? Was it here that he had found her? The pounding on the door, the footsteps rushing towards the bed? The sound he made when he found her dead? He'd have shaken her, I imagine. Slapped her, tried to revive her, dragged her about, knelt over her with his mouth pressed desperately to hers. Now, in her bed, I tried to find her. I lay on my front, but it was too suffocating, so I changed and lay listlessly on my side, my head on my arm, pretending to be a woman who didn't want to live. Then I turned onto my back, and cold surged all along my body. My hands followed it. How full my breasts were, how soft my stomach. In death, everything froze, but my thighs were warm, and the bedclothes were soft against my back. There was the smell of the foxgloves. My bones moved with suppleness under my skin as I pushed my hips upwards, rocking against my fingers. It became almost too much. He's touching me. Me. It's only me. Only me. The heavy wetness on my fingers as if I'd smeared them with honey. When it was over, goosebumps forced themselves up from every patch of bare skin. And the handle of the bedroom door clicked as it turned from the outside, and the door swung open. I shot upright and jerked the bedclothes up around me. But no one appeared in the doorway, and when I marched up to it, there still wasn't anyone there. I looked up and down the empty passageway. In a very small voice I said, SJ? His bedroom door was closed. I closed mine too and returned to bed, only to be jolted from sleep by the sound of the door opening again. It was not a dream or any sort of reverie. There was something terrible about watching the door come open the second time. It opened all the way and with such force that I don't know what stopped it from slamming against the wall. I didn't call out. I closed the door again. There must be something wrong with the door frame or the way the door had been set in it when the place was built. It happened. Doors popping open of their own accord. Bad builders taken to task. The third time the door opened, it felt as if I was being told very sternly to go. But go where? Get out! Clear out! I stood half asleep and held the door closed for 2 hours or so. It began to feel as if I was shaking a small, cold, smooth stump that had been proffered in place of a hand. When I'd had enough of that, I sat, then lay on the blue carpet, hardly aware of what I was doing or where I was. The door opened again as soon as I let go of the handle. Let it stay open, then. Let it stay open. I heaved myself back into bed as a collection of parts, concentrating on getting my arms up over the edge, torso, legs. The next time I opened my eyes, it was very early morning. I put on a pair of slippers that were beside the bed. They were just my size, which gave me something of a jolt. But they were warm, so I left them on. I went down to SJ's study. The plate with the squares of cake on it was still there on his desk, and I wanted to get rid of it. It jarred me. I found it feminine. So I opened the French doors and stepped outside, showering moist crumbs amongst some finches and sparrows who were already pecking at the grass outside. There were seeds in the cake, and it smelt of rum. I hoped the birds wouldn't get too drunk. I wiped my hand on my skirt. Then I stood near the twisted cedar tree, staring. There was just enough light for the leaves to glow. I imagined touching a branch and watching it rise, followed by another branch and another, the trailing leaves parting, so that I could step into the space the tree guarded, the secret place it hunched over for safekeeping from the sun. SJ came out of the house and stood beside me. "Morning." Tentatively, without looking at me, he held out his hand. I took it and held it clasped to my chest. I didn't look at him either. We were eyeing the cedar. "Morning." "What shall we do today?" he asked. We went out walking, wrapped round in scarves and jackets. We tramped down lanes and places in the earth that seemed to have been dug and rubbed until granite came through, then abruptly left. We passed signs with names like Merrymeet and Tremar and St. Clair written on them. And by the time we crossed a low stone bridge with its feet in a shallow pebbled brook, our landscape was three-quarters blue. I began to step gingerly, even though I could see that the ground was firm all around me. There was so much sky that it felt as if we were on a precipice. There was not enough grass to stand on, it was so thin and flat by comparison. We walked around a barrow that rose from the long earth in the shape of a taut shoulder. Every now and again a bird coasted overhead, spreading shadows with the flap of its wings, and I would move uneasily, thinking that it must be coming for us, since there was nothing else for miles but flat tors, and in the distance a hill so vast that it looked both broken and smooth as the eye tried to absorb its image all at once. I ruined my boots in what felt like an unending series of turf pits that had stored the previous week's rainfall. I struggled in the last pit, thinking I was sinking, and SJ crooked his arm and stood still on a safe spot so I could take his elbow and step out. We came to a halt by a lake that seemed to have clouds in it, even though it was a clear day. The moor swept on after the water interrupted it, and looking at the other side, I felt doubled. Without turning, I could see what was behind me. SJ told me stories about the lake. He was a good storyteller, matter of fact, convincing. Excalibur had come out of this lake, he said, and I saw no reason to disbelieve him. I saw kites go up. Small figures rushed along up the hill, their wrists and fists leashed to the bright creatures in the sky. "I want to stay here," I thought. "I want to stay." In the evening, SJ worked, even though he'd said he wouldn't. Sat in the study with huge books opened up all around him, underlining bits of the case studies he was taking notes from. I looked at some cookbooks for a while, then left him and went upstairs to the blue room. With dramatic bravado, I switched all the lights on and went through Daphne's things, moved them around recklessly, daring her. If I was afraid that something bad would happen, why wait? Why not make it happen now? Some papers had been folded into a square and pushed into a corner at the back of one of the dressing table drawers. The words were written in faded, grainy pencil strokes. I had to hold them under the lamp to make them out properly. There was a lot of crossing out. They were the same few sentences over and over, different drafts. The last one read, "I've drunk quite a lot of bleach. Enough to kill me, I shouldn't wonder. I did it on purpose. Daphne. I put my head down on the desk because I felt braver with my head supported. In the corner of the last note, written in small letters and lightly, was L11-24-26. Without lifting my head, I dragged a King James pocket Bible covered in white leather out of another drawer in the dressing table. I set it in front of my nose and looked through it. Leviticus, Lamentations, Luke. Well, it couldn't be Lamentations because that only had 5 chapters. The Leviticus passage was incomplete. The first sentence of it referred to the sentence before it, and the last sentence was an admonition against eating pork and mutton. Luke said, "When the unclean spirit is gone out of a man, he walketh through dry places, seeking rest, and finding none, he saith, I will return unto my house whence I came out. And when he cometh, he findeth it swept and garnished. Then goeth he, and taketh to him 7 other spirits, more wicked than himself, and they enter in and dwell there. And the last state of that man is worse than the first." My gaze snagged on 2 parts of the passage again and again. I will return unto my house whence I came out. 7 spirits, more wicked than himself. I read the passage aloud. I couldn't help it. Better that than keep it as a thought. As I said the last word, the rocking chair groaned behind me, exactly as if someone had sat down in it. And the chair began to rock. I changed my mind. I didn't want her there. I didn't. I ran, leaping 3 steps at a time, coming down so hard I almost turned my ankle. S.J. looked up when I re-entered the study, breathless. "What is it?" he asked. There was a note in his voice, as if he knew. "Nothing." I lay down at his feet, my breasts against the rug. I turned the pages of a cookbook and pretended to read, but really I was imagining him walking across my back, his heel grinding into the base of my spine, the next step pushing the vertebrae away from each other. By the time he reached my neck, I'd be in pieces. He wouldn't do it, but he could. He had the ability. With his lips and hands, he refigured me, coaxing me into moving so closely with him that we disappeared and left a trail of sighs behind us. Not just in the bed. Against walls, across tables, on floors, with my heels dancing the same pleading 2 steps over his shoulder blades. But we didn't go into the blue room again. "Where's all the downstairs furniture?" I asked him in the morning. He looked wary. "In the cellar," he said. There was a little platform immediately inside the cellar door and a staircase leading straight down. It was gloomy once the door had closed behind us. "You first," S.J. said in my ear. So I went first, sending a torch beam ahead of me with one hand and feeling my way with the other. S.J.'s hands collided with mine, and I heard him breathing behind me. There were a lot of chairs and tables packed into a very small amount of space. It was like climbing out into a sea of brocade and velvet padding. Insects wriggled around between the armchairs, and chair legs fell apart as I moved them out of my way. I picked bits up and saw that they were worn through with holes. Woodworm. We stayed down there until we'd identified some pieces that were salvageable, taking turns sitting on each chair and leaning against each table to be sure. It was a slow, airless hour, full of rustling, like someone whispering through cloth. From time to time I trained the torch on S.J. He kept looking at me, looking away, then back at me, quietly surprised that I was still there. We dragged the whole pieces out and arranged them in the rooms they belonged to. The place began to look less like an austere puzzle. I tampered with his placement of the sofas and armchairs and side tables and vases, and he tampered ceaselessly with mine. When we caught each other in the act, we pretended we hadn't seen. Those were the rules of playing house. The next afternoon, we went down to a cove in the opposite direction from the one we'd taken to get to the moor. It was only a little cove. It sloped down to the water smoothly. Gravely, as if guiding me into the deep of his secrets, S.J. showed me the markings on the stones he collected. Darkness fell, and we stripped down to wetsuits and walked into the sea. When we tired of swimming, I just floated and span in the gloss of the water, and he bobbed beside me. We were top and tails. He held my ankles so I didn't float away too far. I texted Jonas, happy, and he sent the word back to me, happy. I ignored my agent's phone calls and deleted the threats he left me via voicemail. I was smiling in a way that felt new, so fresh. It was like another face, and I didn't want to stop, not even for the moment needed to take one of those pictures people said were so good, the ones in which a girl with blank and shiny eyes stood on one leg, looked over her shoulder, was an acrobat, was no one. The day S.J. went back to work, I dashed around Briar Moss, buying things to cook for a dinner party in the evening. He wanted me to meet some of his friends. Two female friends and two male friends. They were all single, so he was also hoping to set them up. I bought candles and flowers and artichokes and steak and braced myself for a frosty reception from the single female friends. It wasn't unlikely that they had stayed single in the hopes that he might suddenly fall for them. When I came back from town, I went into SJ's study to fetch a cookbook. He'd left the French doors open, and in going to close them, I almost trod on a finch. The bird lay on its back in between the doors, and didn't take fright at my drawing so near. Its beak and feet pointed at the sky, blackened, as if blasted by flame. It had died with its eyes open, and some liquid in them congealing. And there were more just outside. I stopped counting after 10. They were all in the same condition. There were more birds chirping from somewhere. There were still birds, still singing, but I couldn't see them. They must be very high up. For a moment I thought I'd be sick, but I wasn't sick. The majority of the bodies were congregated in an uneven half-ring around the cedar tree. Oh! My eyes flickered closed. For a moment I saw myself, standing on the grass, cake flowing from my hand like sand. My eyes opened again. I used a rolled-up magazine to push the bodies towards each other into a heap. I wanted to dig so that I could bury them, but I had nothing to dig with. I tried a little with my hands, and it took a long time to make even the slightest pocket in the ground. I had to cook the food. I had to get ready for guests. I didn't want people to arrive and find me here, scrabbling in the earth with my fingernails. I just had to leave the birds where they were. I went into the kitchen and stood beside the arger, staring at the wall. It was on. It had been on all morning. I'd laughed at it when I first saw it, but it gave off serious warmth. Dinner would be ready, possibly even burnt, in no time. And then I would have nothing to do. I think I'm going to have to go. I grasped gratefully at that thought. I became busy. I chopped the steak and made a marinade for the artichokes. I closed the kitchen door and lined the bottom of it with tea towels. I opened the oven door and knelt down and breathed blue, dancing gas. I coughed, but without urgency. I was dizzy, and the heat around me was not unpleasant. It was like being lost in a fog when you had nowhere in particular to go. It didn't matter. I collapsed onto my stomach and looked to the side. Not that there was anything to see, apart from grey-coated metal. I began to choke. I couldn't move. I wanted to, but my head wouldn't do it. The fog was in it. I heard a distant sound, a dial turning. The arger shut down. No more blue, just gaping blackness. Someone was crouching near me. She put a hand on my leg. My skin shrieked. I can't explain how it felt. There was movement beneath her fingernails. "You're an idiot," she said. Her voice wasn't at all the way I'd imagined it. It was clear and firm. Nothing's wrong here. Can't you see that? Nothing's wrong. Next time, just don't feed the birds with cake that's been experimentally laced with pharmaceuticals. You'll listen to me, Mary Fox, or whatever your name is. Stay here. There's a decent man here who will probably fall for you if you don't make a mess of things. He'll take care of you, and you take care of him. No point having any more death. My mother. My father. I couldn't speak. Yes, she said, I know. But you're what happens next. That's all I wanted to tell you upstairs, but you ran like the Hound of the Baskervilles or something. Thank you, Daphne, I whispered. Oh, yes, you owe me one. So you'll tell him? Tell him what? That it's not his fault about me? Because it's not. I'll tell him. Don't just say it. Make him believe it. How? Make him believe it. She squeezed my ankle. I will. I'm tired, she said. I'm going now. Be bad. Be wicked. And you should worry. But don't. Mary stayed out of my way for a couple of weeks. I was busy with Daphne, trying to get her to like me again and call off the death threats from her friends. I began teaching Daphne to drive. She was fearless, a little too fearless for my taste, and she learned fast. She'd bought a pair of driving gloves specially, and her hands rested serenely on the wheel when it was her turn to try taking a corner. We drove down to the pheasant farm I used to shoot at when I was coming up, 15 minutes away, but it took us 35 with Daphne driving. She brought a pheasant back with us and cooked it up for dinner. It was the worst meal I'd ever encountered, but I choked it down and appreciated it. She was trying, and I was trying. It'd be wrong to say my wife hasn't got any go in her. On our honeymoon, she spent the best part of a morning leaping around a rock garden, bouncing from ledge to ledge like a lunatic, and singing some almost offensively sugary song. She slipped and twisted her ankle, but she didn't howl about it. She bit her lip and she cried a little because she said she didn't want to pretend it didn't hurt. And she hobbled around good-humoredly, taking snapshots and studying the gaudy little paintings for sale on the streets, just as solemnly as if they were up in a gallery. Remembering that she'd cried, I got a doctor to look at her ankle for when we got back to the hotel. It was a sprain. I'd have understood if she'd howled. Another day we drove down to the state park. It's called the Devil's Hop Yard. That was a pretty good afternoon. Close to the waterfall, each tree quivers as if trying to shake itself awake from a bad dream without waking the others up. And the stones all around the waterfall itself are half hollowed out. We looked at stone after stone for almost an hour. The hollows were definite, as if someone had come along with a scoop and removed the heart of each stone. "These are the reason this place is called the Devil's Hop Yard," I told Daphne. "People around here used to say the devil himself made the marks in the stones with his hooves as he walked over them." "It's the only explanation," Daphne said solemnly. I found myself playing with her hair, just sort of mussing it and walking my fingers down the strands until they fell back into place again. "How's Mary?" she asked me, almost straight-faced. Almost. "Mary who?" I asked. That night, after love, she rolled away from me and sat up in her own bed. I was falling asleep, but she sat in a way that demanded I look at her. She had her hand on the top of her head as if trying to keep something in. "What is it?" I asked. I stretched out an arm. "Come back." She stayed where she was. "I've just got to go and, you know." She was whispering as if she didn't want to be overheard, even though we were the only ones in the house. "Oh, okay, honey. Good thing you remembered." Daphne sponged with Lysol disinfectant to keep from getting pregnant. It worked, too. She hadn't wanted a kid when we got married, and I hadn't argued. I closed my eyes. Daphne didn't move. I felt her weight a few inches away, warm and still. I opened my eyes again. She was looking at me, and her smile had crumpled. What? Have we run out? No. What is it, Dee? You want me to? You want me to go and, you know? You don't want to? I was alarmed, and I sounded alarmed. It wasn't the thought of a baby per se. It was just the sudden change. She might as well have pulled the mattress right out from under me. She smiled, falsely, brightly. She scrambled out of bed. Okay, thanks for letting me know how you feel. Hey, Dee, hold on. Hold on just a second. She vanished into the bathroom. I went up to the closed door and heard nothing. The taps didn't turn on. She might have opened the cupboard and reached for the yellow bottle that sat between my razor and her set of heated curlers. But if she had, then she'd done it with infamous and unnecessary stealth. After a few more minutes, I became convinced she'd climbed out the window and run off into the night. I knocked on the door. Dee!
Yes, darling?
Are you going to come out?
Yes, in a minute.
There are things I should have said to her then, but I didn't say any of them. I thought I'd tell her when she came out. She didn't come out. She was still in there when I fell asleep. I woke up at some point before dawn, and she was there in bed beside me, nestled up against me. She'd taken my arm and put it around her, and I was grateful, pathetically grateful. Next time the matter came up, I would say the things I knew I should say. Very early the next morning, we walked down to Cloud Cove and walked out across the sand to the island. It was accessible on foot when the tide was out, and I wanted to show Daphne the lighthouse. I own it. I mean, I inherited it. And just like my father, who inherited it from his father, I don't know what the hell to do with it. So I just make sure it gets a good spring cleaning from top to bottom 3 times a year, and keep some books there. My great-grandfather won the place in a game of cards. I always think I might go over there to work, but I never do. Daphne and I didn't talk much on the way over. We picked up bits of driftwood, shells, and pebbles, and arranged them on the ground when we felt we'd carried them too far away from where we'd picked them up. The wind nipped us through our clothes. "Oh, God," Daphne said as the lighthouse came into view. She said, "Oh, God," again and again with every step we took towards it. "It looks evil." It wasn't evil. It was just a white tower with long slits for windows. Not even a particularly tall tower. She liked it better when we were inside, and she saw that it was spick and span and modern. I took her up to the lantern room, and she stared at the lantern through the glass panels. It was the size of a man and covered in dust. I pointed out the lenses that surrounded it, and explained how they refracted the light from the lantern and made it fly out in all directions the way she'd seen it in movies. When I took her to the watchroom, she insisted on turning the handles that rotated the lamp lenses. We heard the lenses whirring. Not a comfortable sound to have above you, like huge wings flapping in place. But there was no kerosene in the lamp, and even if there had been, it was morning, so the whole thing was a pretty pointless exercise. "You must have loved this place as a boy," she said as we came down the spiral staircase. "It must have been like a 4-story playground." She'd brought some logbooks down with her, clutched against her chest, even though I'd warned her that all she'd find written there was times and dates and comings and goings and observations on what direction the wind was coming from. "Not really," I told her. "I didn't see the point of it." "All right, well, normal kids would love it." She'd brought a flask full of coffee and some rolls, and we had those at the kitchen table. She looked over the logbooks, lost interest after about 4 pages, as I had predicted, but soldiered on. I left her at the table and went to go and pack up a few books I wanted. I dragged a couple of crates over to the back door so I could look out at the sea while I searched. The tide was high and choppy, but not so that I couldn't see across the cove. I looked from my books to the water, from my books to the water. Sunlight flashed once, twice, three times on the waves. The fourth time I saw that it wasn't light. It was a hand, raised up at the end of an arm, and it was waving at me. Gradually, Mary Fox walked out of the sea and paced across the sand towards me. She wasn't smiling. Her hands were behind her back. She looked as if she had a lot on her mind. Once she was standing directly before me, she dropped a curtsy. Mary.
Yes, Mr. Fox?
I think I know what we're trying to do with this game of ours.
Tell me.
We've been trying to fall in love. She raised her eyebrows.
With each other?
She asked coolly. Would you let me finish?
With pleasure.
We've been trying to fall in love, yes, with each other, but we've been trying to take some of the danger out of it. So no one ends up maimed or dead. We're trying for something normal and nice. Mary folded her arms.
That is not what we're trying to do.
Oh, what then?
Your wife loves you. Turn to her properly. Stop fobbing her off and being a counterfeit companion. It would be good if, after all this, just once you wrote something where people come together instead of falling apart. Just show me you can do it, and I'll leave you alone.
But I don't want you to leave me alone. She turned to face the sea. The wind whipped her hair around. Her hair is a miraculous color, like autumn leaves shaken down around her shoulders. She looked wild and lovely. Mary, if you were real, I'd run away with you forever. I went to her. We faced each other. She said, "You're cruel, Mr. Fox." Her voice, her eyes. She was weary. My heart was doing that jerking thing it did when I thought Daphne might leave me, but worse, much, much worse, almost unbearable. I was about to go off like a bomb or something. It actually hurt. Please don't let me keel over on the sand at this woman's feet.
"I would like to have breakfast with you," Mary Fox said, "and I would like to have you defer a little to my tastes and habits. At present I have none, because you haven't given me any. I'd like to go to dinner parties with you and play charades. I'd like to have friends to lend me books and tell me secrets. I would like to have nothing to do with you for hours on end, and then come back and find you. Come back with things I've thought and found out all on my own, not through you. I'd like not to disappear when you're not thinking about me."
She enunciated her words very slowly and carefully. As she spoke, I saw that I had proposed the impossible.
"So if you did find some way for me to be real and for me to be together with you, then I wouldn't mind that. I wouldn't mind at all."
"Honey," Daphne called out, "shouldn't we go before it gets dark?"
Mary wasn't there anymore. She'd never passed out of my sight so abruptly before. I was shaken. And Daphne mustn't know that I was shaken. I'd told her she had nothing to worry about where Mary was concerned. I'd said it wasn't like that. Had I lied? To Daphne? Or just now to Mary? I'll say anything to get out of a spot. I counted to 10, holding my chest like a fool, like young Werther, guarding his sorrows. Then I went to Daphne. She was sitting on the front steps with a paperback. It had to be War and Peace, it was thick enough. The title was in Cyrillic, and so were all the contents.
"Is that Russian?" I asked her.
She answered in words that left me stone cold. Russian, I presumed.
"Daphne!"
It made her laugh, the way I was looking at her. She winked.
"Don't worry, I'm not possessed. I said I'm just brushing up. I've been taking a correspondence course. You've got a lot to find out about me, my friend."
She looked a little cold, so I put my jacket around her shoulders, and we strolled down to wait at the post where the ferry came in. And she leaned against me. And it was all right. Hide. Seek. Once, in Asyut, east of Cairo, a boy was born to a market trading family fallen on hard times, a family too poor to keep him, unless he had somehow been born full grown and ready to work. The boy's tiny mother had given birth to 5 big, healthy, noisy boys before him. But the first thing this particular boy did when he was born was cough quietly and turn a blind, bewildered glare on his brothers, who elbowed each other and watched him closely. This new boy was far too small. He had to be spanked 6 times before he proved his lungs to the midwife, and even then his cry wasn't lusty enough. He was limp and wouldn't cling to a finger when it was placed in his palm. He refused his mother's breast, wrinkling his nose at the knotty brown bud of her nipple, with slow bafflement. Yet his eyes said he needed something. The boy's mother saw into the future. Her mind hunkered down in the midst of her tiredness and spread the dead circle of her nerves until it overlapped into her next life, her next fatigue. The boy's mother saw that she wouldn't be able to coax this son, to coddle him, to silently cherish him, to let him fall and find no help, to do all of the things that it would take for this boy to survive into his strength as a man. She looked into his eyes. They were like a famine. Seeing them sent hurt and light through her, his eyes kept asking, asking, and she knew that a person could die trying to love him. If it hadn't been certain before, the decision not to keep the boy was now absolute.
"You will not be strong,"
the boy's father winced when news of the birth was brought to him at his sand-blown stall.
"He will not be of use."
He didn't tell the other men, whose threadbare robes jostled his at market, because it was not a good thing to have to send a child away.
"He will not be strong," the midwife said, averting her eyes from the child's.
She left as soon as she could, with promises that she would tell all the doctors she knew about the child, in the hope that they knew of some infertile couple. Sunset on the outskirts of Asyut brought clarity. Even from the narrow side streets where damp sand beads and breathes, any window can tell you why they say here the world began with a brother and sister locked in a beautiful circus trick. In Egypt, like everywhere, the land is made to fit the sky. But here it is more so. Here it is possible to say, "This is land," and point, and "This is sky," and point. But the eye can't discover the dividing line. Nut cranes her neck over her long, lithe blue back to kiss Geb, and Geb cradles her. Careful, because she is nothing, less than nothing, but if he should drop her, it would be the end of everything. The boy's mother was comforted by sunset, and she closed the shutters and began preparing her new son's cot. The next day's noon came like a blazing hoop, and the sun spat razor blades through it. People did what they had to do to keep from wilting. Slim women waddled, fat women crept close to the ground, barely taking steps. Amongst them came a tall, ramrod straight woman in pure black. She parted the jostling knots of people in bounding spurts, like a dark thought. She was accompanied by the boy's midwife. The woman took the market trader's son away with her because, she said, she needed a seeker, and this boy was one. The woman's voice was soft, and you had to listen hard for it, otherwise you thought she was trying to speak to you with her eyes alone. The atmosphere around this woman told of books and fine rugs. The boy's mother cried and held herself, held her leaking breasts as the woman took her son away. But she didn't change her mind. A girl was born in Oshogbo, in a small hospital a few feet away from a stone shrine to love. The girl was a heavy baby with features that were pleasing because they were fluid and made her simple to look at, as if she was carved all of a piece. The girl was very quick learning to walk, speak in both English and Yoruba, eat solids, use her potty, smile in a certain way that brought maturity down like an axe on her face. At 6 years old, she prostrated herself before her elders unasked. She clambered over her milestones with unassailable, businesslike calm. No cute lisping, no unusual habits. It took the girl's parents a long time to realize that their daughter's docility and sweetness was, in fact, vacancy, a kind of sleepiness, and an instinct for ease that translated itself to her entire body. The girl's hair grew soft and light, so that combs flashed through it without tangling, so that it sat well in plaits. Blemishes fell away from the girl's skin with simple soap and water. The same question, put to this girl 2 times in a row, would yield 2 different answers, depending on who asked the girl the question and in what tone. The day that he saw that it was enough, the girl's father was chauffeuring a sweaty, bearded oil executive to the airport. The girl's father looked away for a moment from the well-fed face, from the firm, confident mouth of his passenger in the rearview mirror, and saw his daughter following a street vendor home, nodding and smiling in the shade of the bush-lined thoroughfare, a sack of the street vendor's rice piled across her shoulders with a sturdy, troubling grace. The girl's father bundled her into the car without ceremony or apology to his passenger, and at home he thrashed her with a walking cane. He held her head down on the kitchen table as he beat her, and his fingers dug into her scalp. But he did not feel her neck tensing against him, and she didn't make a sound. He kept on hitting her because he wasn't sure whether she was feeling this or not. The neighbours came en masse, some with their fingers entwined in the fur at the scruff of their goats' necks, and they remonstrated with him. Women pulled off their head wraps and wrung their hands. "It is too much," everyone told him. The girl's father stopped when he was tired of hammering on her bones. He watched her breathing. Her shoulder blades rose and fell with her head turned away from him and into the table. When she lifted her head, she said unsteadily, "Sorry, Daddy." Blood welled from the space between her lips. The boy grew up with a hard smile and a complicated manner that was at once condescending and eager. He developed a gait that made him seem arrogant. These were attempts to counteract his eyes and their treacherous tendency to ask. He wasn't handsome or talkative, but his adoptive mother made sure that he dressed well in English tailoring and American denim. And his sadness was luminous. Girls his age gave him kisses and held his hand even when they shied away from other boys. Women offered him honeyed pastries, confidences, concern. He walked the markets and puffed pipe smoke in corner tea houses, breathed in the spice pod musk of men, and took their advice with throwaway thanks. The woman who had adopted him was a widow, and it was possible that her bereavement had made her mad. The boy's new home terrified him because the downstairs was bright and softly pastel-coloured and air-conditioned, but the upstairs was cordoned off. If he looked hard enough, he could make out doors and bare floors, but that was all. At night, he slept on a couch beside the woman who had adopted him. The woman herself slept on a boat-shaped chaise longue. It took her body in a way that he would never see again, let her sleep with grace, although her arms and legs were bunched up and her feet were hanging off the end of the couch. It didn't seem to matter very much that the woman didn't grow older as he grew older either, though he suspected that something about the woman herself slowed him down, bathed his thoughts in perfume, set his dreams afloat so that his mind was abuzz with stranger things than her age, or her solitude, or the silent upstairs. The woman insisted on being called Mother, which the boy called her, but with a secret hiss that came from a place inside him that he did not understand. Inside his head, her name became Mother, smothered myrrh. She was an art collector, but she only collected art that was body pieces. One considered piece at a time, painstaking finds, because she was looking for a collection that, when put together in a room, would create the suggestion of a woman who crammed the room from wall to wall. The boy took telephone calls and messages left for his new mother by her contacts all over the world. He travelled Egypt with her and observed cemetery graffiti as she did, so closely that she almost inhaled it. In hundreds of perfumeries, they watch glassblowers torture air between their hands, force it to become solid. Always, as they travelled, she pointed and asked him, "Do you like that? What do you see there?" He told her the truth, and she always listened to him. She said that he chose well. But when they got home, the boy did not ever feel anything in the presence of these well-turned ankles and smooth calves, these arms and shoulders captured in shade and the moment of motion. They were a collection, not a woman. Then the boy and his mother got a face for their collection. The face was a photograph. The photograph was of a girl who had died with her family one night when her neighbours smashed the door down and took an axe to all the living inside that house. The neighbours did this because a radio broadcast told them to. The radio broadcast advised them not to wait for the evil that lived next door to grow and get the better of them. And so it was done. But after killing the family, the neighbours had not touched anything else in the girl's house, which is how the boy and his new mother, picking over this room at the end of a series of devastated rooms, found the girl's picture. At first, the boy thought that it would be wrong to take the picture. But it was a picture unlike any other. It had been taken in the backyard of the house at some point between the sun's disappearance and the illumination of the moon. The girl's smile did not seem to correspond to the presence of the camera, or even to a joke told off camera. Her smile was unnerving because it had no reason. They took the picture home, even though the boy's new mother complained that it wasn't art. Then the boy's new mother asked him what he thought of their almost complete collection, waved her arms at all the fineness and said, "You want someone. Is she here?" He said, "No." "We need a heart," the boy's new mother said. And when she looked at him in that moment, she seemed to him so high. It seemed that her feet connected to the ground only tenuously, and it was her shadow that bore her up. The boy thought in that moment that this woman must be beautiful. No, of course she was. Fine eyes, wide curved lips, and cheekbones like slanted hooks. But at the same time, he thought that his new mother must be a spider. What nobody knew about the docile girl from Oshogbo was that her heart was too heavy, and that almost from birth she had felt its weight, a gravitational pull that invited her to her grave. Her heart was heavy because it was open, and so things filled it, and so things rushed out of it, but still the heart kept beating, tough and frighteningly powerful, and meaning to shrug off the rest of her and continue on its own. People soon learned that they could play on her sympathy, and because she was terrified that one day this unasked-for conscience of hers might kill her, she gave away whatever money she earned, gave away bread and went without. The girl tried several times to give her love away, but her love would not stay with the person she gave it to and snuck back to her heart without a sound. What people didn't know about this girl was that the ancestral dead kept her company. They came to find her at bath time and sat four at a time in the bath water with her, cooing wistfully and using their wasted, insubstantial hands to wash her hair. The girl urged them to take care of their own children, but they refused. Her head lolled at these times, and she was overcome with gratitude. At bedtime, the dead took her with them, and in her dreams, she visited their graves. At first, in rebellion against her heaviness, the girl thought that she needed to be thinner, and she took to reading imported women's magazines on credit from a bookstall owner. The magazines talked about calories and saving calories and keeping some back so that you could have a glass of wine. One day at the dinner table, the girl asked her mother for an estimate of how many calories there were in the fried stew that bubbled at the bottom of her bowl beneath a layer of iba. There is no Yoruba word for calories, and so her mother just looked at her and said musingly, smilingly in English, "Calories?" as if she was trying to understand a punchline hidden between the syllables. Then the girl didn't ask any more and just sat looking at the food, which was bottomless and made to sink hunger. The girl decided that she had to hide her heart somewhere until she was big enough to keep hold of its weight. One night, the dead helped her, some stroking her hair and soothing her, while others hooked their fingers into her and carefully lifted a strand of steam from her chest. The girl took her heart, and that cool night she was frightened, even though she walked amid a crowd of other people's ancestors. The shrine was a rectangle of stone arches that spoke of other kinds of love, strange, ugly, smoke and choking sort of love, carvings of cruel hands that killed candle flames to break refusal in the dark, women thrusting out hard breasts and genitals. Also in the carvings was the kind of love that wakes you up from nightmares. And also there was a sundial of wise children's faces. The shrine was the kind of place where a Valentine's heart would have trembled and wilted. With her fingers, the girl scratched a place for herself in the north wall and slipped her heart through into the dry moss behind the stone. And she walked away, and she walked away. And that was that, and that was that. Because he had been told to, the boy looked for hearts. He examined unusual playing cards and alabaster chess pieces and went to London with his new mother to examine posters plastered onto the walls of public transport stations. On the boy's 21st birthday, his new mother took him to the west coast of his continent to view a shrine where one of their contacts had told her you could hear and feel a heart beating when it grew dark. They stood amidst a small crowd of other curious people and waited for sunset, which came with a slow earthquake that sent the ground slipping away until they realized that the sensation was the legendary heartbeat. The boy, now a man, stood a little apart from his new mother, who listened intently. And the heartbeat said things to them both, things that made the boy smile with all of his soul in his face, things that made the new mother suck in her cheeks and look suddenly pinched and old. They stayed long after everyone had gone and fell asleep at dawn with their heads laid on rocks converted to pillows with thick shawls. When the next morning came around, the asking in the man's eyes was so powerful that no one could look at him without offering. 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 The girl was lighter without her heart. She danced barefoot on the hot roads, and her feet were not cut by the stones or glass that studded her way. She spoke to the dead whenever they visited her. She tried to be kind, but they realized that they no longer had anything in common with her, and she realized it too. So they went their separate ways. Other people became closed to the girl, and she enjoyed it this way. At the marketplace, she handed over her bread and exacted the correct payment for it with a slight pressure of the hand and an uncaring smile. When the girl moved amongst people, she felt as if she were walking in a public place at an hour of the night when it is too dark to come out, or at noon when it is too hot to be outside, and all the doors around were closed and barred. The girl felt this solitude to be an adventure. She moved away from her parents and went to live by herself on the ground floor of a tenement, even though this was frowned upon. When she was not working or wandering, She listened to the white noise inside her head, or she sat on her bare floor and listened to people arguing, romancing, accusing, the people all around her. She let their words fall into her body like coins into a bottomless well. Sometimes she thought about her heart and wondered how it was doing without her. But the girl was never